Hey, how's it going? Hi.
Hi.
It's the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond. And joining me as ever is my best buddy. He's the apple of my eye. He is smart. He is ideas.
Younger. Yeah.
Richer.
Taller.
Happier.
Fatter.
Knows what a serviette is.
Yeah,
it's Mr.
Yeah.
Joe Devine.
Hello there, how are you?
On today's episode, we're not doing a movie you forgot. We're doing
a movie you will forget you saw.
We're doing a movie you forgot you saw or yeah. Didn't even go to see or heard it was yeah. a bit shit. Yeah. It's a special, you know, we've done Gladiator as a Joe special and now we're doing a Joe and Adam went to the cinema special. We're doing Gladiator 2.
Yeah, yeah. For a bit. But there's emails in this sort of dotted throughout as well. Some very nice emails sent in. So if you're one of the people that sent in an email, you certainly can't stop listening now, can you? Even though the chances are that we're not going to read the one that you sent in. But it's cruel, isn't it? It's cruel. They all have to hang on now.
To jump ahead to Letterboxd Corner, someone said that they felt outraged. But at the end of, what was it? I think it was the end of the lobster episode. They felt this yeah. close to getting to the communal list. They were so close to the communal list and then Almost Famous, like robbed them at the last. I should name check them, but I can't be asked to get my phone. Sorry. But thanks for the message. And they were very fond of Almost Famous and it made them think ill of Almost Famous.
It's a good episode, Almost Famous. It hasn't been released yet as we speak, but it's a good one.
It is a good. I absolutely make an absolute cunt of myself saying it didn't win awards and it wouldn't win awards. And Cameron Crowe won best fucking original screenplay. But,
yeah.
Oh, God, such a shameful... You know what? I do have a fair bit of defence for that before we get into the episode.
Oh, sure. It seems really important.
It does. Well, cause
what's this for, though? Let's just, before we get into it, can you just explain what the value is of you defending something that doesn't matter, that no one thought badly of you for?
I have an ego.
Because all that really happened was that you use the wrong information, aka that the film didn't win any awards, to steer you in the wrong direction during the box office game, right? And nobody listening to that thought... This guy is a real doofus, a really stupid guy. This guy's been pretending that he knows more than he does. Or like, why does he have that tone, that authoritative tone, as though he's earned it or something?
Yeah.
When he doesn't even know, he doesn't even check, like, not just any awards, but like, he doesn't even check the Academy Awards for the one film in the week that you do an episode on. Like, nobody listened to it and thought that it discredited you in any way. So what possible reason could there be for you to want to feel the need to defend it? It just seems like, you know, it seems like a mental illness to me.
Well, I don't like to do too much research on a film because I worry that I'm going to strike upon the box office figures. And that is actually the most fun I have in the whole episode. I don't like talking to you generally. But I really look forward to that moment when you go, tell me, what was the box office? US and Canada. And that like fun little way you do. It's the highlight of my week.
It's funny because you act like you hate it every episode.
It's the biggest moment for me. And I feel I want to be pristine. And so I am in preparation for an episode. All I'm doing is re-watching a film. And I'm accessing my memories about the film.
Okay.
And when I'm accessing memories, what I'm doing is I'm accessing a prejudice that I've held against the film for a number of years.
Yeah.
So the reason why I don't know that Cameron Crowe won an Oscar, that feels like
Cameron
a fuck. Cameron Crowe, that, mate, Jesus Christ, what a wake-up call.
Sure.
That's a wake-up call. I cannot...
I think it's a forgivable error, though. I don't think you would watch Almost Famous and then think, I think the person who wrote this is definitely winning a Best Screenplay Award. I'm not sure of that. I think it's a fine film, but, you know, it's a bit of a stretch, isn't it?
It's not a fine film. It is a indictment of the Academy that won Best Screenplay. There we go. Done. So let's chat about... Let's talk about the cinema. Take the audience through what, you know, going to the cinema with me is.
Well, The film starts at, well, the screening starts at 7,
yeah.
But we get there at 5, right?
Of course we do, yeah.
Because we were at Picture House Central, and for people who don't live in London or haven't been there before, if you're a Picture House member, you get access to the lovely Picture House bar in that cinema, in the central location. And there's like a three-story bar. There's like lots of quiet little places to sit, and people go there to, you know, to do remote working and stuff. And there's a roof terrace where you can smoke, so that's great for me. And in fact, I often go there to meet, this isn't an advert, by the way, but it probably should be, when I have to meet someone in central London, when it's always busy and you can never, you know, you can't ever get away from people, I'll go there even if I'm not going to the cinema. It's a fantastic place. So we met there a couple of hours beforehand. We were chatting. It got pretty heavy, the chatting. But you were supping. You were having a little sup. And and I wasn't drinking. So by the time we got into the screen, you were quite excited. You were quite, well, not excited, you were quite excitable. I think there's a very key distinction between those two things. You were quite excitable, and I wasn't.
You were dead, you know, mate. You were full on deadpan.
I was full on deadpan, yeah.
You wanted to be excited, but you were showing some reticence for being excited.
I was scared.
You were scared. And I said, no, don't be scared now. Be excited now, because this is the only juice you're going to get.
Yeah.
If the film's amazing, brilliant, but if it's shit, you're going to feel like shit. So, like, let's be excited.
That turned out to be very prescient.
Let's be excited now. Enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, and I was, to a certain extent. But then we got into the screening. It was very busy. It wasn't quite sold out, but it, you know, effectively was.
It was pretty, but pretty. I haven't been in a packed. It felt packed to me. Over three quarters packed.
You kindly got me an aisle seat at my request, which I always enjoy. And you were sitting next to someone else, and we were in front of someone and behind someone. And anyway, we've talked about being in the cinema together before on this podcast. The listeners will know that you're a shusher, right? Oh. Which is, I think, it's a great, admirable trait. I admire you for being a shusher. I am scared when I go to the cinema with you, because I am not a shusher. And once or twice when we've been together before, you've done a bit of shushing, and it really scares me when you shush someone. So now I'm anxious that you're going to shush someone, right? And there's that on the one hand. The other thing...
What a gladiator going to the cinema in central London at 7 o'clock on a fucking Friday night. Like, I give a shit. Like, I could give a shit. Like, I would love people to be talking throughout this movie.
And then the second thing is that you have the very hard and fast rules about when you need to stop talking. But up until that point, you're the loudest person in the room. And if I go to the cinema, we've talked about this before as well, even if it's just the adverts, right? Even if it's pre-trailers, but it's the adverts, and there's a couple talking, I'm sitting there thinking they're continuous,
yeah,
right?
We've
they're going to continue
yeah,
to chat
a
through the
here.
Film.
Sure.
We've got a problem here. I'm already anxious about it. I'm already in my head. I'm already thinking, oh, God, if Adam was here, he'd be shushing. I'm not going to shush. Who am I? Where's my value? You know? And so I also, whilst I'm simultaneously anxious that you're going to shush someone, I'm also anxious that people around us are thinking that we are continuous, even though I know that we're not. I feel like wearing a sign that says, don't worry, we won't talk when the film starts.
We are not continuous.
We're not continuous, right? We're not continuous. We're stoppers. We're stoppers. And anyway, you'd had a couple of drinks. You were pretty loud. At one point, I kind of whispered, you know, you do this trick with people when they're speaking too loudly where you talk really quietly back to them. And normally they kind of unconsciously adjust.
And I just went, what? I shouted, what? What are you saying?
And I said, Adam, I said, listen, can you just be a bit quieter? And you were like, sure, no problem. And then like 10 seconds later, you were back to the same volume again.
I have the armor of knowing that I don't say a fucking word in a movie.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's, if anyone around me is the equivalent of me thinking, oh, hello, that guy over there, he's looking at me, he's thinking, he's a possible chatter.
He's a possible continuer.
I've no concern to anyone in the grand scheme of things. So if anything, I can be louder and I will be louder.
Right. No, and I think that's fine. Again, like what I'm actually describing here is the difference between you and me. You as long as you're following the rules, you're happy to not care what anybody else is experiencing, right? Me, I'm so anxious about causing any anxiety, any uncertainty. I'm basically anxious about having any impact on anybody else, even if it's not at rule-breaking point. I'm worried to cause someone to even consider that the rules might be broken, even when they're not being broken, right? So I'm all about just keeping it locked down, locked tight, right down. Yeah, don't even be in, don't even dare. But you were having a good time.
Oh, Nosferatu, Nosferatu. Do you want to see this, Joe? Sure. Do you want to see this film, Nosferatu? Yeah.
Or laughing more loudly than I've ever heard you laugh before. Or, you know, when you thought the trailers had finished and you went to the toilet and you came back and you'd missed the whole trailer for the finale of Mission Impossible. And you walked back into a pretty quiet room with about 400 people in it and you went, fuck, no! At the top of your voice.
Come on, that's funny. That's funny.
Sure.
Because obviously, I come in and I've seen the end, and I knew that the new Mission Impossible trailer was attached to this flick. And I thought, oh, I need a piss. The Gladiator 2 is about a million hours long. Yeah. I don't want to miss a second. And I came back in, and then I saw the font, and it was for the end, and I was genuinely annoyed. I was like, I would have loved to have seen that fucking trailer on the big screen, and I wanted everyone else to know, and I also wanted to send out a little frisson of danger,
right?
Because it's Friday night.
Sure, you want people to feel on edge. Yeah,
I don't want them to think that they're going to enjoy this.
There's a little bit of toxicity.
Fuck off.
You know, like magnetism in the air. You know.
I think.
Anyway, you didn't miss anything in that trailer. Let me tell you, the trailer. All it did was it combined different clips and scenes from all the different Mission Impossible films throughout the years, as though to create the illusion that there is some kind of emotional through line in Mission Impossible. When we all know there isn't. It looks exactly the same as all the other films, and I'm sure it will be, but with the added cloying factor of everyone knowing it's the last one, you know? If anything, that's probably the thing that will make it better than the others, because I know I won't have to watch another one.
I think that will make it worse. I would watch these forever. The right. Cloying factor, the cloyingness of them has been turning up as they have been heading to this end point.
They've been burning up the cloy.
No, just turn it off. Just make the movie. The film isn't about whether this is the first or the last or the middle. The movie's the movie. I couldn't give a fucking shit if this is the last one that Tomothy Cruise makes. Just make a fucking movie where he's got a fucking mission and it's impossible and he fucking does it. That is it. Anyway.
Do you think it's telling that the first 20 minutes of this podcast about Gladiator 2 were talking about before the film had started in the cinema?
It is partly telling, but what I wanted to get done with is let's just do this. Uh-huh. Let's everyone just take a moment of silence. Check your watches, you know. Yeah. Look to your loved ones. Remember this moment.
What if people are alone in the where they are? Think about the. Imagine them.
Imagine them. Or here's a better one. Look at your contacts lists and your favorites, or just look at that name and think of that name. Really soak in this moment, okay? Because this is the moment where you really are going to understand that Mr. Joe Devine. He called it, yeah. Okay, he called it. Whatever you think you know about life or Gladiator or Gladiator 2, forget it. Throw it out the window. He called it months ago. He said it. It's on record. Go back in time. Go back through the podcast. Listen to the Gladiator episode. You'll hear him say the words. Mescal doesn't have it, okay? And that guy, the guy who said that, Not me. I didn't say it. Mr. Joe Devine said it. He was absolutely fucking right.
I questioned it. I questioned it. And I want to caveat and preface this conversation.
Let me lead you into it. I'm leading you into it.
No, but I want to say... before you do that. No, hold on.
Oh, you're going to say it.
Hold on. Okay. We're going to try to not spoil the plot points of the story of the film, okay? We are going to try to do that. But I make no promises that will happen. And if anything... I don't even believe that will happen. Okay, so you stay here now of your own volition, and don't come, you know, talking to me or Adam. Error of ways on Letterboxd. Don't follow him and start complaining because he will follow you back if the film's been spoiled for you. We'll try not to, but you know, that's all I can say.
If you've seen the film Gladiator, then I believe the plot points of Gladiator 2. Therein lie. So I don't believe Joe was...
Are you saying Gladiator spoiled Gladiator 2? Is that what you're saying?
Really, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's possible to spoil Gladiator 2. There might be one possible shoe to drop.
Yeah.
Which we would never drop that shoe.
I'm not sure I ever know what that shoe is.
Exactly. So. He's not going to drop it, guys, because he's forgotten the film already.
Yeah, pretty much.
So listen, Joe, you called it. Mescal can't do it.
I sort of called it. I called into question whether or not he could. All I said was that we were yet to see whether he can or not. I had hope and love in my heart that he would, and I should say, I still have that hope and love that I think a Paul Mescal 8 years older, a la the age that Rusty Crowe was when he filmed Gladiator 1, maybe that Paul Mescal can do it. But the 28-year-old Paul Mescal. He certainly didn't do it. Whether he can or not, I guess, is a different question.
Shall I do the letterboxed of Gladiator 2?
Yeah, go on. Do the letterboxed. Yeah.
Quick letterboxed. Gladiator 2, 2024, directed by Ridley Scott, written by David Scarpa, based on characters created by David Franzoni. He created those characters, and here's the letterbox. It's 148 minutes. Jesus Christ, I felt every single one of those minutes. Prepare to be entertained. Years after witnessing the death of the revered hero Maximus at the hands of his uncle, Lucius... Oh, wait. I hate how these are written. Years after witnessing the death of the revered hero Maximus at the hands of his uncle, Lucius is forced to enter the Colosseum after his home is conquered by the tyrannical emperors who now lead Rome with an iron fist. So there's two emperors and they hold it with one fist.
Sure.
With rage in his heart and the future of the empire at stake, Lucius, played by Paul Mescal, I haven't even said that, must look
Paul
to...
Paul Mescal, I think we're supposed to say, aren't we?
Oh yeah, I keep saying Mescal.
I think it's hard in this one because you've got Pablo Pascal as well, but I think he said it's Mescal. So Paul Mescal.
No, yeah. And I also got called out by one of I won't say who because you're just just a lad on Letterboxd called me out.
Is it Darren Olin?
Lucius, played by Paul Mescal, must look to his past to find strength and honor to return the glory of Rome to his people. There is no mention of the Denzel Washington character in that Letterboxd, who I would say is a fairly important character. So anyway, that's the flick. The flick is Gladiator 1 with the Oliver Reed character played by Denzel Washington with a slightly different character arc. And the one interesting addition is the Pedro Pascal character, who plays a warmonger of sorts at the beginning, but a conflicted one.
I mean, he essentially plays he really is Maximus. You know, imagine if Maximus hadn't died in the first film. If the events of the first film hadn't happened to Maximus, then Pedro Pascal essentially plays who Maximus would have been in the second, you know?
Oh, mate. God, tell me more. Can we just watch that movie?
Yeah, I would like to, because also Pedro Pascal's great. He's good in the film. He's good in the film, right?
He's the only one who gets it. He's the only one with any gravitas to carry it all. He's got the meatiest role, but then sort of disappears. And I know that Denzel Washington is in this, and there is no meat in Denzel's performance. It's a joke. It's a fucking pantomime, and it's very really boring. I mean, I'm specifically saying that about Denzel Washington, which is a criminal waste. You know, he's one of the finest actors of his generation. I don't know, fucking hell, what a film. What a boring film. It was the funnest thing was just looking to you and, like, just seeing how livid you were. And the face of grim, like, oh, shit, this is rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the first 20 minutes of the film, I watched and I thought, I think this is shit, but I'm not convinced yet, you know. The rhythm, the flow, the pausing, I mean, the lack of pausing, I should say, all had me thinking, this feels like a kind of the advert version of the first film. I didn't like the style, the way it was made at all. And then something happens 20 minutes in where the conceit of this scene is that Paul Mescal successfully fights a very large baboon. And I turn to you. And I made a face as if to suggest, yeah, my suspicions have been confirmed. This is not a good film. It's actually probably worse than not a good film. I think in parts it's actively a bad film.
When I was at that point, I was feeling quite kind towards the film because I felt like it was resolving storytelling problems that I had with Gladiator, which are probably even though I've recently rewatched it. I probably misguided. I thought, I just felt like watching Gladiator 2. I was like, oh, I think it's solving more of my story problems. But every single minute that passed, I just realized you're just creating new, different story problems that you didn't even need to create.
Mm. And it felt quite convoluted.
Ludicrously convoluted. And then it made the storytelling of Gladiator feel positively fucking pristine.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I think that's my problem. I think my biggest problem with it, because I can forgive performances and I can forgive... I think that there's a magic to the rhythm of cinema that in 99% of films, it's not going to be right. You know, so the expectation that any film I go and see has that rhythm and has that magic to it, that musicality to it. I think that's an unfair expectation on my part. When I witness that, I should just bask in it and enjoy that, you know. And Gladiator 2 definitely doesn't have it in the way that I think the first film does. But far worse and I think unforgivable is, and this might be an editing problem, it might be that there was a longer original director's cut where it makes sense. You know, I've heard so many people tell me about Kingdom of Heaven since we did that episode, that the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven is way better, that it makes way more sense, that a lot of the problems that you and I talked about in that film of character motivation, of the lack of scale and scope, of how it just didn't make sense why Orlando Bloom's character made certain decisions or said things at certain times. They say the director's cut completely solves, you know, all of those problems. And even if it's not an amazing film, it suddenly makes sense in a way that the feature film version didn't. I think, or the theatrical release version didn't. I think that's possibly the problem here with Gladiator 2. Because as the film moves on, and that story, as you said, becomes more and more convoluted, characters like Paul Mescal start to say things and make decisions and react to other characters in ways that don't make any sense at all, right? And not just like, okay, I can forgive them that, or they've skipped a beat here, or like, no, a complete 180 on what was happening 10 minutes ago, okay? It is totally, totally unforgivable in a film of this scale for that to happen.
And there is also, you can see there's so much ADR in this. You can tell there's so many reverse...
Explain what ADR is.
Okay, there's so much ADR, and by that, and Joe's told me to explain what this is, and I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. So ham-fisted. Like, not only did you restart it to do it again, but then you said why you'd restart it.
I'm not gonna say this to people. Listen, Joe's asked me to explain what ADR is. Now I know you guys know what ADR is. Joe doesn't think you know what ADR is. ADR is audio recorded after the fact over the film.
What does it stand for?
Audio directed recording. It doesn't matter. It's called ADR. I don't need to know what it is.
Yeah. No, for sure. Of
no,
course.
I mean, obviously I do, but I...
It's a chord dangereux routier, which translates to European Agreement Concerning the International Carriage of Dangerous Goods by Road.
Yeah.
There you go. How about that? How about that?
All it is, it's when audio, as recorded live, didn't come out because of the explosions or whatever. You get a character to come back, you get an actor to come back and re-record their dialogue.
It's dubbing.
It's sort of dubbing, but it's not dubbing because it's the original actor who did the voice, and it can cover a multitude of sins. So it's just an actor going back to re-record their lines. Or what it is mainly used as is when a film has fucked it and doesn't know what they'll do is they'll cut to the reverse of that character. And a character who you can't see their mouth moving, they'll have that character say a line like, so you're going to go and do that thing now, are you?
Yeah.
They didn't say it at the time because they all thought the story was perfectly understandable.
Sure.
And an audience has been shown the film and they've gone, why has he gone to do that? What's going on? I don't understand.
Who's this character that's been on screen for 45 minutes already, and when they've already said his name five times, I still don't know who it is.
And also they've done a cut where the studio have gone, this film, Gladiator 2, is 4 hours long. Ridley, can you cut it down? Mm. And he's gone, oh, fine, all right, if I have to. And loads of plot, loads of script has to just go down to the toilet, and they have to do exactly what you've said.
So that's ADR.
That's ADR. Sorry, I had to explain it. I didn't feel like I had to, but then Joe said I had to explain it.
Sure.
But yeah, there's lots of that, and Ridley Scott doesn't say he doesn't need to do director's cuts these days. He's Mr. Billy Big Bollocks, so. It's on him.
Right. It's on him. It's his fault then.
It's all on him.
I mean, I was deeply disappointed by that. And I think it's either a bad filmmaking decision, or it's a real misunderstanding of what made the first film work so well. Because there are elements, as you well know, of the first film that are a bit silly and are a bit, you know, pantomime. But you really, really believe that Russell Crowe is angry about his dead wife and son, and you really, really believe that he wants revenge for that. And you really, really believe that his revenge plot aligns also quite neatly with some of the things that he might politically also lean towards too, right? So it makes sense and you follow through, and you can kind of ignore some of these sillier elements of it because that central conceit makes sense. What Paul Mescal wants in this film changes every 5 minutes. It never makes any sense. I don't care about it at all. I do not care. He doesn't, and we'll talk about Mescal now, right? But let me start by saying his wife dies at the beginning of the film, okay? And I don't know, we'll talk about his performance and the nuances of it, but I don't believe that he cares about that. And that's also not the thing that his character is even doing anything motivated by from the second half of the film onwards, right? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's hugely disappointing. And I do believe that Paul Mescal is a better actor than the film has allowed him to show himself as. Whether he can do this role or not, I think that's what we should talk about now. But I think the film probably also does him a disservice, as well as Denzel Washington, who you've already said is a terrific actor, and the film makes him look like a shallow piece of shit.
Yeah, I think the whole film is massively out of its time. It ends with Paul Mescal giving a big old grand speech. Times have changed. Why am I watching a film where a white man gives an inspirational speech to change the course of history? This is so tone deaf. And so weak. It's laughable when fucking Big Mel does it, but it's at least Mel fucking sells it, and at least Rusty Crowe sells it.
Rusty Crowe undersells it as well in Gladiator 1, I would say.
Mescal, modern man Mescal, you can tell his heart isn't in it. That scene in particular, it's absolutely, you can see it on his face. He can see he doesn't believe it.
Sure.
Because he's a modern man.
It's not in the locker of a modern man. that thing.
Listen, I'm saying things back to you that you said to me. I really wanted Mescal to be the guy for this. And it's the thing is, he's too good for it. Like, I don't want, this guy doesn't belong in this kind of film. Ridley Scott is 86 years old. This film is it's dead. It's got nothing of any interest. It's got nothing to say about the world.
It's vapid.
And also, Hans Zimmer hasn't done the score. But also, it's just amazing to see your face throughout just be like fucking livid.
Well, let's stay on Mescal's face because, not my face, but Mescal's face. I think he follows on from actors like Ryan Gosling, for example. Ryan Gosling, another great example of a leading male actor in modern Hollywood for a younger generation who expect and want different things from their leading male actors, which I think, to clarify, is a good thing, right? I want to say that as a caveat. I think it's better. I think After Sun is a beautiful film, and I laugh at the idea of an actor of less talent than Paul Mescal, or perhaps even a talented actor of a significantly prior generation, trying to convey the sort of thing that he was able to in that film. It would be out of time, out of character. It would be a strange thing, right? In the same way, Paul Mescal does not belong in this film. He just doesn't. What Rusty Crowe was able to bring to Gladiator 1 was an incredible power through silence a lot of the time, through like solemnity. He commanded the set, right? Like, it didn't matter who else you put up in front of him. It didn't matter that he was in scenes with Oliver Reed, for example. Rusty Crowe commanded the set. His presence commanded the screen. That does not happen in this film. Even though we've already said Denzel Washington, unfortunately, I don't think it shows the best side of Denzel's range. Paul Mescal doesn't own a scene with anyone that he's in this film. He doesn't have the presence to command it. Maybe in 8 years' time, 10 years' time, he will do when he's slightly older. I think part of the problem is that you've cast someone too young to do this anyway. I think that's a big problem. But what he has is the ability to communicate an incredible depth of vulnerability through only his eyes. Through only his eyes. And there are scenes in this film where he makes fuck eyes at people, which is what he's so good at doing. It's the magic, it's the Mescal magic, as you watch it and you just fucking swim. They are deep, deep oceans of vulnerability and melancholy and sexiness and like all of these different emotions all mixed up into one. He is the ideal leading man for a modern generation. He can't do Gladiator. This film maybe shouldn't exist now, you know, and maybe that's just the answer. Like, I don't think anyone of his age or his generation could have done a better job. I laugh at the idea of Ryan Gosling trying to do this, right? But you tell me someone who is as good as Mescal, who's his age or younger, who could have done that. I think it's just the wrong film to make and the wrong casting choice. And that's what I was worried about when we talked about Gladiator 1 a few months ago.
A long time ago, I was in Burma. My friends and I were working for the local government. They were trying to buy the loyalty of tribal leaders by bribing them with precious stones. But their caravans were being raided in a forest north of Rangoon by a bandit. So we went looking for the stones. But in 6 months, we never met anyone who traded with him. One day, I saw a child playing with a ruby the size of a tangerine. The bandit had been throwing them away.
So why steal it?
Well, because he thought it was good sport, because some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world.
Did you know that Rotten Tomatoes celebrated their 25th anniversary recently, Adam?
Have you got an email about that?
Oh, shit.
Has someone emailed us about that?
I have, but actually I'm going to come to that email, a nice email from Nat. I'm going to get to that after this first bit of it. Good recall, though, because I forgot that. Now, listen, Rotten Tomatoes, in order to celebrate their 25 years of existence, they created a couple of lists. One of them, the first one here, is critics pick the best movies of the last 25 years. And here's how it works, right? They sent out a survey to individually approved tomato meter critics, asking them to choose in no particular order their top five movies. And then they tallied the votes and they narrowed down the most popular 25 titles. And then they created a list. So I'm going to read the list to you now from 25 down to 1. And you're going to react either in agreement or with, you know, a broad sense of disgust.
Will you react?
Sure, we can react together if you like. I mean, I know the list, but we can react together. I don't think you're going to have too much truck with number 25, though. Because in at number 25, with a 94% tomato meter rating, 2016, Denis Villeneuve... It's Arrival.
Should be way higher, I imagine. But yeah, brilliant. Lovely. I've got a full truck. I hold full truck with that yeah. Shout.
Now, let's see if we can hold it. I haven't actually seen this next film, but I know that people like it. In at number 24, it's Black Panther from 2018 with a 96% tomato meter.
Nope.
Is it just the same as all the other Marvel ones?
No, yeah, it's worse. It's actually worse. It's not a good film.
Right. In at number 23 is, now, it's from 2017. It's directed by Paul King. It's got a 99% tomato. It's Paddington 2. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, great.
Which I watched and I thought, you know, maybe I'm a bit concerned with my viewing of Paddington 2 because I watched it around last year's festive season. And because my wife had wanted, you know, to watch something a bit more kind of uplifting. You know, she'd heard a lot of good things about Paddington 2, as we all have. And I watched it. And the only thing, it's one of two things, right? It's either a completely dog shit film, because I hated it. Or it's me watching The King's Speech for the first time and hating it because of the context and the whole setting and how much it appears to celebrate, you know, a nation without a fucking soul. And you know how it tries to find fun and meaning in things that don't have any meaning and aren't any fun, you know. But actually, I think it probably is quite a good film, and I just hated it because of me.
It has supposedly topped Shawshank in terms of how well regarded it is.
Right.
Thing is, having watched Paddington 3, that's a shit film.
Right. Right.
That's the shit Paddington film. We should feel lucky that a film like Paddington 2 exists, because Paddington 3 is like what Paddington 1 or 2 would have been.
Yeah, you can hate a good film, can't you? That's fine. Well, listen, the next entrant, number 22, I think you might have a little truck. It's 2011's Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life, which has an 85% tomato meter rating. The critics' consensus here, I'll give you something to think about. Terrence Malick's singularly deliberate style may prove unrewarding for some, but for patient viewers, as though to suggest that you aren't patient, The Tree of Life is an emotional as well as visual treat. I don't know if I'd call that film a treat. I didn't hate it, but it's not a treat.
It's not a treat. And also, yeah, I mean, this is the whole problem with the Rotten Tomatoes system. The reviews for these films are not... They are reviews for themselves.
Right.
And they are reviews for, like, telling people what they like.
And what they think what they like says about them.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I like Tree of Life, therefore I'm more complex than you.
Yeah.
That's a very judgmental thing to say.
It's true, though.
Right. I mean, it sometimes might be true, but also I do believe that some people actually like The Tree of Life and aren't considering whether that makes them more complex or not. In at number 21 is Inglourious Basterds from 2009, which is, I mean, I can't remember if there are any other Quentin Tarantinos on this list, but it's probably not the one I would pick. But, you know, okay.
Yeah, fine.
Is it in the top 25 films of the last 25 years? I don't know, but maybe.
If it's a Quentin Tarantino joint, you got to sling it on there because he's pristine. He's an auteur. But yeah, like it's a pretty fun flick. I wouldn't put it anywhere near a top 25.
No. Well, what about this one? David Fincher's Zodiac in at number 20. I haven't seen it, but I know people really like it.
Yep,
just a firm yep.
Yeah,
great.
Absolutely.
We're following on that firm yep with a second and even firmer yep for 19th placed The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. I think whether you like it or not, it's 100% in the top 25 films of the last 25 years. It's a hard yep from you as well.
You won't. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
It's below on the list of film that it shouldn't be below, but you'll be happy about. In at number 18 is Inside Llewellyn Davis. Inside Llewyn Davis, I'm supposed to Llewyn say. Davis. Not Llewellyn.
Yeah, definitely prefer that to Return of the King.
No, Fellowship of the Ring.
Whatever, Return of the King. Fellowship. Oh, sorry, is it Fellowship?
It's Fellowship.
Oh, great. Yeah, no, it's better than Fellowship as well. It's better than all of them.
For God's sake.
That's the best bit of this bit. I can't believe I go.
In at number 17. Now, listen, I don't need 5 minutes on every film, but also I don't just want you laughing at Lord of the Rings the whole rest of this list, okay? You watch that mouth. In at number 17.
Yeah.
Intense, inspiring, well-acted, Damien Chazelle's Whiplash, 2014.
Absolutely.
Yeah. For me, that feels like the first definite yes of
really?
All of the...
Really? The first?
Apart from Lord of the Rings. That feels like the first definite yes. In at number 16, with a significantly lower tomato meter rating, but it's making this list, is PTA's Magnolia, 1999.
Yeah, abso-fucking-lutely.
You could genuinely get me on Magnolia, by the way. It's been such a long time since I've seen that film. In at number 15, Everything Everywhere All at Once from 2022. I think the most recent film so far on this list.
That is an absolute forgot you forgot.
I do think it's a canon forgot you forgot. I do.
I really didn't like it.
I enjoyed watching most of it, but like I understand why people were so excited about it because it was very different and it was it felt kind of novel for what it was. I think sometimes people confuse novel with good, right? And that it exists is a great thing, and it was pretty funny in parts, but I didn't understand why it like swept awards season, you know.
I thought it was shit and I didn't like it. And I'd been told that Everything All at Once was supposed to be the greatest thing ever.
Right.
And guess what? I didn't think it was.
Yeah. I think, you know, we should do it then. We should do it at some point because it is a canon forget you forgot, I think.
I don't want to do it because I'm too respectful of the regard with which people hold films. It was like, yeah, it would be like if someone was telling me that Fight Club is bullshit. And I don't want to be the guy telling someone that Fight Club is shit. So I'm not going to do that to everything, everywhere, all at once.
Number 14. Another 2016 movie. It's Moonlight.
I've still never seen it.
What? You haven't seen it? Did I know that?
I keep lining it up. It's lined up to be watched, but I have not seen it.
Man, I think you can't let it go a decade without watching Moonlight.
I can let it go as long as I like.
Oh, you shouldn't, though. It's a really good film. It deserves your eyes, I would say.
Yeah, I know. I will.
All right. Well, I think it's worthy of a place on this list. I'll put it that way. It would make my 25, I think.
Great. Probably. Yeah, yeah. That's what I hear. I'm going to watch it pretty ASAP now because I've been the finger has been wagged.
Sure. I've wagged that big finger. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, number 13 is 2017's Get Out, directed by Jordan Peele.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, pretty good. Pretty good, wasn't it? Fine. Okay, another PTA now. Another PTA.
Can I guess and the PTA?
I don't mean it's a parent-teacher
Can I guess
meeting.
It?
Mm, yeah, of course you can, yeah.
It's There Will Be Blood.
It is. In at number 12 from 2007, There Will Be Blood. Critics' consensus. Widely touted as a masterpiece, this sparse and sprawling epic about the underhanded heroes of capitalism boasts incredible performances and leads. Fucking hell. Boasts incredible performances by leads Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Dano, and is director Paul Thomas Anderson's best work to date. That's the critics' consensus.
It's not his best work to date. But
what's his
fine.
Best work to date?
Not. They don't get to fucking decide that.
No,
that's
I'm
the
saying,
end
but,
of the.
But for you,
no. I don't. What I say is irrelevant. It's fucking irrelevant what they say. Shut up.
What do you think his best work today is?
That's none of my business. I know what it is.
What, can you just tell me what you think?
No,
it is?
I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Why not? Because you haven't got an answer.
Follow me on Letterboxd, mate. Find out what it is. How dare!
I love that that's wrinkled you, and you won't even, you don't even have an answer for what's better than that.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. No, I know what his best work
just
today is.
Spell it to me. Whisper it. Just whisper it.
Joe, I am not. It's not my position to say that. And it's not anyone's position to say that.
But isn't this like the whole point of the list? Like, aren't all these people, aren't all of
segment.
These films saying...
This is not
like,
my segment.
No,
this
I know. I'm just curious that you've reacted so angrily to that specific comment when, for presumably, them including Get Out on this list and not Nope means that they also think that Get Out is Jordan Peele's best film to date.
Obviously, Nope isn't on the list because Nope is fucking rubbish.
Right.
Whereas Get Out was a seminal, vital, game-changing bit of psychological horror.
So in that world, it's okay for them to say that it's Jordan Peele's best work to date?
Well, that's because that's like saying the sky's blue. Of course it is, because he hasn't made any other good film.
Right, but then how come...
But Paul Thomas and Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson's made
Paul
fucking
Thomas
more.
And Anderson.
Paul Thomas and Anderson's made more, obviously.
It's a maths issue you've got here. It's just that it's a numbers issue that you're finding, you found truck with.
It would be like someone saying, Pulp Fiction is Quentin Tarantino's best film. Is it? I think you'd have to debate that issue. Any director with more than obviously one good film, you can fucking get into the argument. Jordan Peele has only directed one good film.
Yeah.
Ipso facto, that's the best film he's made.
Right, 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 right. Sure. Now, in at number 11, 2007, it's No Country for Old Men. Critics' consensus, bolstered by powerful lead performances from Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, and Tommy Lee Jones, No Country for Old Men finds the Coen brothers spinning cinematic gold out of Cormac McCarthy's grim, darkly funny novel in their best work to date.
Jesus Christ.
It didn't say that about that. It didn't say that. I just added that in at the end there to see
well
if it
played.
Would rile you up. Because you wouldn't argue that, right? That is their best work to date, obviously.
No.
It's obviously is their best work to date.
I'll argue that to the fucking council. It's there's no obviously about it.
I like Miller's Crossing. Ooh. I'm Adam. I like Miller's Crossing.
I wasn't even thinking of Miller's Crossing, but obviously Miller's Crossing.
I like Raising Arizona. I actually think Raising Arizona's better than No Country for Old Men.
No. You could say Fargo. You could say Miller's Crossing. You could say The Big Lebowski. You could say...
You couldn't say any of those films.
No, you couldn't, but I could. And also you could say fucking Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? These are all fucking taste things. All of those films. Yeah, fuck off. Like, what the point is like the fucking arrogance for someone to go, clearly the best film. No.
Right. Take a breather for one second. Okay.
You've wound me up.
I haven't wound you up.
Is
what's
absolutely
happened? What's happened
me
here
up.
is that we've steered off course as far as you're concerned. I've started to host, and you've lost your marbles. immediately you're furious at everything. Anyone's opinion. Furious. Absolutely.
Okay,
right. Now,
okay, wait. I'm
now,
listen. Breathing. I'm taking a deep breath. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm absolutely old. I'm all at sea when I'm not the host.
How many cans have you had? Number 10, it's The Social Network, yeah? Because that is the 10th best film of the last 25 years. Another David Fincher. Fincher getting on here twice.
This is all... It's a popularity contest. More people saw Social Network. It hit bigger, and so it's higher. You know, the whole thing starts to fall to pieces. But
no,
whatever.
Of course.
Fine,
of
fine,
course.
Fine, 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 fine.
But here's one you can't disagree with now, though, okay? In at number 9, it's The Matrix. I think that is one of the best 25 films of the last 25 years.
Yeah, but I don't think it's that high.
Maybe not, but like, it just its inclusion on the list, I think, is fair.
Okay, great. Yeah, fine. But just...
You know, in terms of what it means, right? Not just... It doesn't necessarily mean that from a filmmaking... From a story perspective, for example, is it the best? Maybe it is. Or from a filmmaking perspective, maybe... I don't know. I'm kind of defeating my own point. I guess what I'm saying is just... You have to include what it meant when it was released as well. How many people talked about it? Like, what impact it made on the world? And The Matrix made an undeniably enormous impact on the world.
Absolutely,
right?
It did.
In at number 8 is Pan's Labyrinth from 2006. And that's, of course, Guillermo del Toro. I think it's fine. I think it's obviously a very, very well-made film, and I respect the craft involved. But I don't like it, you know?
Tell me more.
I think it's wrong. I mean, I think The Matrix...
Why?
It not only is it a better film, it's more interesting to watch. Its impact on the world was far, far greater than Pan's Labyrinth. And I think it's just... It also holds up better and has got Keanu Reeves in it, and Pan's Labyrinth doesn't. But we're at number 7 now, and I think you're going to... I'm hoping you'll kind of broadly agree with all of these, okay?
I think it's everything, basically everything that you've said is fine and belongs on the list, and I'm
sure,
fine with it.
Sure, of course. Spirited Away.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Could be higher maybe, but you know. I'm happy this next film is on the list even though I haven't seen it, because I want to see it and we've been intending to for some time. It's In the Mood for Love from the year 2000. Kar-Wai Wong, the director there. I've heard it's great.
Wong Kar-Wai. I like to call him Wong Kar-Wai.
Right.
That's what you like to call him. That wasn't me being facetious. I thought he was called Wong Kar-Wai.
Right, yeah. No, I think that happens, doesn't it, with like Hyun-Min Son and Son Hyun-Ming. He's Korean, for example, but sometimes it's unclear whether the family name or the forename goes. So I don't know. But they've written Kar-Wai Wong here. But Wong Kar-Wai, also fine, I think. Probably fine.
I think it's true. I think it is Wong. I think he's gone on record as saying...
Wong Kar-Wai.
Call me Wong Kar-Wai.
Call me Wong Kar-Wai. Okay, fine. Well, let's do that then, next time we speak about Wong Kar-Wai. In at number 4, The Dark Knight, Nolan Christopher.
Yes, please. I think we, you know, yes. And we're also needling in on the list of popularity. I agree, but then they're also going, this is a Craven list. They don't want to get nerds ragging on them, going, where's The Dark Knight? What? Even, I bet there'll be livid fans who go, like, hate mail the mum of the editor of fucking Rotten Tomatoes. That's not number one. Gets firebombed. Yeah, yeah. You know, that's just the world we live
about
in.
Something about firebombs. Yeah. All right, now, come on, center yourself. Get a hold of yourself for the top 3, okay?
Jesus Christ,
get a hold of yourself.
You're a drunken lunatic. 25 films.
No, I know, but you've just been a shouty, sweary wreck for the last 10 minutes, okay? Center yourself. Come on. In at number 3, 2001. He's got emphysema and he can't walk around without oxygen now. It's Mulholland Drive.
Yeah. It's a good flip.
I love that's what happens when you center yourself. You just go, yeah.
I mean, I will tell if you want me to toe the line, I'll toe the line. It's a pretty good flip.
Sure, okay. Now we've got the top 2 now, and I'm going to tell you both of them, and then you can tell me which order you think they're in. Okay, a little mini game. Now there is Mad Max Fury Road from 2015. And then there's Parasite from 2019.
Parasite's number 1.
Parasite's number 2.
What?
Critics' consensus, an urgent, brilliantly layered look at timely social themes, Parasite finds writer-director Bong Joon-ho in near total command of his craft. And yeah, in at number 1, Mad Max Fury Road from 2015. Critics' consensus, with exhilarating action and a surprising amount of narrative heft, Mad Max Fury Road brings George Miller's post-apocalyptic franchise roaring vigorously back into life. Listen, it would have made my 25. Would I have put it at number 1? Absolutely not, obviously. But I think it's a brilliant film. I really like it. I know you don't rate it that much, but I think it's... When I watched it for the first time, I thought, that's one of the best films I've seen in the last decade. You know, instantly I felt that.
I think I wanted a different film when I saw it. I rewatched it quite a time after, I realised a bit more what I realised it. Yeah, I liked it a lot more. You could totally get me on Parasite.
Same. You could get me on Parasite as well. I've watched it the once in the cinema. I thought it was brilliant, and then I've never desired to watch it ever again. Well, there we go. Listen, that was the critics list. But this now brings me to an email from Nat, who wrote in to say, "Hi guys, I hope you're well. Big fan of the podcast. Just as an addendum to the tomato game you guys mentioned at the end of last episode, there's also a fans list next to the critic list with a surprising amount of crossover, at least surprising to me," Nat says. "Might be interesting to compare the fan list versus the critic perception. Just a thought." An excellent thought, Nat. We're not going to take as long to go through it, but I'm going to rush through this list and so you can hear what's made both lists and what new additions are on the fan list that didn't make the critics list. Okay, Adam? Yeah. So Whiplash is still here, for example. There Will Be Blood is still on the list. Mad Max Fury Road also on the list, but way down in 19th place, so the fans didn't think it was number one. No Country for Old Men, Inglourious Basterds makes it also. Everything Everywhere All at Once did make the list, as did Parasite and The Fellowship of the Ring and The Matrix. And The Dark Knight also made the list, but it's number one. The Dark Knight tops the fans list, as opposed to just being, I don't know, sixth or whatever.
That makes of course it does.
Yeah, unsurprising, isn't it? Here's the films that are on the fans list that weren't on the critics list. We've got Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind from 2004, yes. Which I think that's a fair addition. That's a really good film, really
superb,
interesting.
Absolutely,
it deserves its place. It would have deserved a place on the critics list as well. And actually, I'm slightly more surprised to see it on the fans list than on the critics list. If I had to pick which one of those it would be on, I would have assumed maybe it was on the critics list. But hey, there you go. The audiences know. They're good, right?
Yeah, they know.
Some of them know. La La Land.
Yep.
I think that's really fair. I think that's a fucking great film. And every time I watch it, I think it's better than the last time.
These omissions are very, very revealing of these so-called critics. That's all I'll say.
Well, what do you think about this one, though? The Departed.
Yep. I mean, I don't...
Yeah,
I mean,
great film. Is it an omission from the top 25?
It beats some of the other ones. It's better, like, but
that's true.
No critic would put that on there because they'd go, I'm too. I don't want to look like I'm.
Like a normal person. Yeah, well, Gladiator also made it on here, which I am fully supportive of. I think that's an omission from the first list, but I'm not sure that you'd agree.
I wouldn't, but I'll let it on.
Sure. Both Spider-Man animated films, both Across the Spider-Verse and Into the Spider-Verse, have made it onto this list.
Yeah, of course. Okay, fine. All right.
Yeah, you know, as has Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah.
Which, you know,
I think that
they deserve some credit. I don't know if it's one of the best 25 films.
Well, if you're putting Lord of the Rings on there, then you have to put Infinity Land on there.
Well, I mean, they're just not the same thing by any stretch of the imagination.
No, but they're not the same thing, but they are Infinity... I called it Infinity Land. That's a Biffy Clyro reference. Infinity War and Endgame, they are as good and a cinematic achievement in the same way that...
Sure.
It's just your taste.
But no, that's fine. This is as a cinematic achievement. I mean, Endgame is also on the list in number five.
Yeah, so you're reacting against them with some kind of snobbery. They are as good as, if not better than the Lord of the Rings films, and you don't think that they are. But then,
I mean, I don't think they are from a storytelling perspective or an acting performance perspective. But I do agree with you that they are as big an achievement as the Lord of the Rings films, if not a bigger achievement from a much broader context. I just think the films and like...
It's a taste thing, because I'd much rather prefer watching both of those, Infinity War and Endgame.
Yeah,
I think
right.
I prefer the tone of the acting and the decisions.
That's so wild to me. I'll accept it and I'll say, okay, fine, that's just me being snobby then. But it's verging on like insane to me that you would say what you just said. But fair enough. If that is actually true and you're not just saying it to upset me.
I would never dream of saying it just to upset you.
I mean, you would. But like, are you sure you actually think that? You don't have to explain it anymore, but just know that when you say yes to this, that you're locking this in with deadly friendship trust. You do actually think the acting and the story is just as good, if not better, in those two Marvel films as it is in the Lord of the Rings films. That's what you think. Because I'll straight up accept it if you say yes, but you're saying this in the safety of the deepest level of our friendship. And if I get a sniff that you're just saying this to upset me, you're going to be in big trouble.
I worry that what I'm basing it on is what I would want to watch more. Mm. And what I want to watch more any time, any day of the week, would be Infinity War Endgame. I would never want to sit down and rewatch any of the Lord of the Rings.
But that is a different thing.
Because the thing is, people.
Because sometimes
know.
I might prefer to watch Pineapple Express than, you know, the fucking Godfather.
If you had managed to record the special Lord of the Rings episode, people would really know what my feelings are about Lord of the Rings are. But they're never going to know about my specific issues. And they're very specific. I don't say these things with any. There's no malice, you know. There's no. There's no casual thing. I'm being very specific. I've got very deep, specific feelings about these films. I watched these films at your house, at your behest, over 2 days. We spoke about them at length. Well, no one's ever going to know what I think about them. What I'm saying though is.
Wait.
It's just an agree to disagree sort of situation. I believe you. I believe you now. But for some reason, I think less of you. I don't know why. Top Gun Maverick has made it onto this list.
I don't know about that. Top Gun Maverick.
Fascinating. One of your favourite films, Fight Club, is on here. That was an omission from the critics list.
That's a huge omission.
Yeah, I think it probably is. But in the interest of saving time, Saving Private Ryan's on here. And then also all three Lord of the Rings films make it on instead of just Fellowship. Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, just there in fourth place ahead of Avengers Endgame, as it should be.
Yeah.
Otherwise, Inception and Interstellar both make it into number three and number two. I mean, the top three list is just Nolan, by the way. It's Inception, Interstellar, Dark Knight. That's what the fans say about the last 25 years, that the three best films of the last 25 years are all made by the same director. It's pretty impressive that he's won over the people in that way. One quick final thing from me. A great email in from Adam Bannister here. I didn't want to end the episode before telling you about this one, Adam. Adam Bannister writes in to say, "Hey Joe," just to me, "in case you want to pull Adam up on something he says..." He says autobiographer when he means biographer. It's happened twice now. I'm assuming Adam doesn't read these emails. Thanks, Adam. So there you go. Someone's noticed. Just as you're always paranoid that's going to happen, someone's out there has noticed, not only noticed that you are saying the wrong thing when you mean to say something else, but also is counting the number of times that you've done it and is reporting it to me like a lovely little snitch.
Thanks, Adam Bannister. No, thank you. Do let me know. In the 50 episodes where I fucked up, I do want to know that, and I should check the emails more often. Ah, fucking hell, man, that's gonna fucking ruin me, man. That is absolutely gonna ruin me.